This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Welcome to the Vegan Report. My name is Ryan, and we are kicking off 2026 in full force with an episode featuring Captain Paul Watson, the legend himself. Captain Paul Watson is a marine wildlife conservation and environmental activist. Watson was one of the founding members and directors of Greenpeace. In 1977, he left Greenpeace and founded the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. Today, he is at the helm of the Paul Watson Foundation. We began our conversation by highlighting the incredible life and legacy of departed animal rights giant Brigitte Bardot. We also addressed the very bad press the announcement of her death triggered. Then Captain Watson shared with me his opinion on the infighting in the vegan community, the real reason why Japan wants his head, the behind-the-scenes account of the hostile takeover at Sea Shepherd US, the story of his LSD experience, and much more. Support the Captain Paul Watson Foundation now. Visit the episode notes to connect with the good people there. I hope you missed the show and are ready for a new year full of thought-provoking, insightful, and fascinating conversations with passionate people. Buckle up for what's to come. If you are not following the show, do it already, and share this episode with your fellow vegans. Paul's energy is contagious, and that's the boost we all need to start the new year. Thank you. Also, I wanted to start this conversation by talking about Brigitte Bardot. We lost her a few days ago. She was 91 years old, if I remember correctly. You wrote some beautiful words about her. You called her Saint Brigitte and an angel of mercy. And I wanted, you know, to ask you, how should we remember Brigitte Bardot and her contribution to the animal cause?
Well, I think we should remember her for her achievements. To me, one of the most significant things she did was her contribution to ending the horrible Canadian commercial seal hunt. First of all, starting with the ending of the killing of baby white coat seal pups. And then finally, in 2008, the complete ban on Canadian seal products in the markets around the world, especially Europe. And she was very, very instrumental in achieving both those successes. So what that really translates into is literally millions of lives saved, because the quotas that were being set by the Canadian government is about 400,000 seals a year, and that's not happening anymore. They're still killing seals because the Canadian government subsidizes the kill, although there's no market and the seal pelts just pile up in warehouses, and they subsidize it to about 20 million euros a year. But the kill, although the quota remains, it was 400,000. Now it's an unlimited quota. They can kill as many as they want. But now they only killed, what, last year, 17,000, which is a lot, but still, it's a substantial drop from 400,000.
Yes, you shared on the Paul Watson Foundation Instagram account that picture of Brigitte Bardot with a beautiful seal. I think that's an iconic picture. Can you tell us the story behind that picture?
Yeah, well, in 1977, I was leading my second campaign to oppose the the slaughter of seals in Canada. And my base camp was in a place called Blanc-Sablon in Quebec. And we were there. First of all, I had gone out onto the ice. I got into a confrontation with the sealers. I had been handcuffed to a pile of pelts, dragged across the ice through the water, into the freezing water, then brought up from the deck and dragged through a gauntlet of sealers who were kicking and punching and spitting and at me. And then I was put into a cabin and where I came down with hypothermia. So it was a very agonizing night. And the next morning, the Canadian Mounted Police picked me up and flew me back to Labrador and to Blanc-Sablon. And as I stepped out of the helicopter, this woman came out of nowhere. And she started hugging and kissing me. She called me a hero, and I had no idea who she was. When she went away, I said to one of my people, "Who?" I said, "Who is that?" And they said, "Oh, it's Brigitte Bardot." And I said, "Oh, incredible!" And the next day, we held a press conference with her, and she denounced the seal hunt in very, very stern, emotional ways, much to the dismay of the Canadian government. And that from then on end, she was a substantial, voice for the seals in Canada. And so I've been involved with working for her for every year. That's been about almost 50 years.
Wow, that's incredible. You know, I also want to share something about Brigitte. She stopped a campaign in my native country of Algeria that had started in the mid-19th century of mass extermination of stray cats and dogs. So the government, many governments made the decision every time to invest in catching dogs and cats, putting them in cages, leaving them hungry, starving for days, and then killing them by electrocuting them. So basically sprinkling those cages with water and then, using an electric current. And that was going on since the 19th century. No neutering campaigns. It was deemed, to cost too much. And it's Brigitte who stopped that, who saved millions of lives in my native country by just reaching out to the president of the country. And she did that only a few years ago. So even, the last chapter of the very last chapter of her life, she was dedicated and very much active for the cause.
Well, I think she spent more time protecting animals than she did as an actress and a model and a singer. She quit in 39 to devote herself exclusively to protecting animals. And that's the thing I think she'll be most remembered for. It's the thing that she would most want to be remembered for. So literally there's hundreds, literally millions of animals that are alive and are not suffering today because of the interventions by Brigitte Bardot, who understood the power of her celebrity to reach people and make a difference.
Beautifully said. A few words about France. I think your headquarters are now in France. You're based in France. Brigitte was also very much French. I think she defined in many ways what being French means. What is your relationship with the French culture and the country of France?
Well, I have no problems here. I get along with pretty much everybody. It's an incredible support base. Though it's the one country that has actually come to my aid. For instance, when I was in prison in Greenland, more than anywhere else. So the support here has been incredible and very, very, very much appreciated.
I want to.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first stepfather, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
I'm talking about needing support. I want to go back to what happened in July 2024 when you were arrested by Denmark. It was a real eye-opener for me. That story compelled me to learn more about your work and the pertinence of your work. And what it showed me, you know, what happened to you was a dark side of governments that we deem, you know, democratic and civilized. Use the expression, you know, punishing kindness. And I felt, you know, yes, it's very much that case. And so you were arrested by Denmark, and there was that risk throughout that, you know, ordeal of getting deported to Japan. So my first question is, why does Japan want you?
Well, I know exactly why they want me. As for our campaigns against their illegal whaling operations in the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary, which we ended up stopping them, chasing them out, and they're no longer in the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary, so it was a victory. But the thing that really bothered them was a television show called Whale Wars that we did, which reached millions of people and really humiliated the Japanese whaling industry and the Japanese government. And they want their retribution. They want their revenge. So it's really about a television show more than anything else. We never injured anybody. We never damaged anything, really. We never, you know, all we were doing is intervening against an illegal operation. The charge against me was conspiracy to trespass and conspiracy to obstruct business. These are hardly things that get you on the Interpol red notice. In fact, I'm the only person in history on the Interpol red notice for those two things. I mean, red notices were set up to go after serial killers and war criminals, major drug traffickers. Nobody goes after something for a small, you know, things like that. Even, and in fact, it didn't even happen, but they only make up the charges. But Japan's a very powerful country, and so they exerted a lot of pressure on Interpol and various countries. In a month and a half ago, I was in Brazil, and 2 days after I arrived, I got a call from the Brazilian federal police saying that Japan had demanded my arrest in Brazil, and the Brazilian federal police refused. In fact, they called me up and told me about it, and the Japanese were furious that the Brazilians had actually told me about it. But, you know, they forgot I was actually in Brazil at the invitation of the Brazilian federal police and Interpol and Prince William of the United Kingdom. And so it was hilarious that they were trying to do that. But let me just say about my arrest in Greenland, I saw that as a wonderful opportunity to make a campaign out of it, to focus attention on Japan's illegal whaling operations, with the added benefit of focusing attention on Denmark's illegal killing of pilot whales and dolphins in the Faroe Islands. And the reason that Denmark came after me at the behest of Japan was because the Danes don't like what I do in the Faroe Islands. They wanted their revenge also, and they've been trying to do that for, well, I'd say 25, 30 years. They've been trying to do that. So, you know, I make a lot of enemies, and I make enemies from people who torture and kill animals illegally. Because one of the things that I've done over the last 50 years is where I intervene is against illegal activities. I've never been a protester. I don't protest. I intervene against illegal activities. We're an interventionist group. And I've used it under a strategy which I called aggressive nonviolence. Aggressively intervene, but without causing injury. And in 50 years of doing this, I've never caused a single injury to a single person. I've never been convicted of a felony crime, and I've never lost a civil lawsuit. Because again, our opponents are criminals.
Do you think the Japanese people are on your side? That, you know, it is a focus of maybe a faction of the government or of some, you know, old-fashioned tradition among Japanese elite?
We have Japanese supporters. I received 40, 50 letters when I was in prison from Japan, all very positive. We have a Japanese crew in Taiji right now opposing the dolphin kill in there. So there's a lot of people in Japan who are supportive. But just like in every country, most people don't question their government. And in this case, I would say 99% of the Japanese people just do what their government tells them to do. And so if the government says that they want me for being a terrorist, well, then that's what they'll believe. People believe what they're told. When I was brought into court in Denmark, first of all, I was really mystified as to how come they sent 12 heavily armed Danish police officers to arrest me when I arrived. And when we got into court, I found out why. Because Japan had described me to the Danes as a very extremely dangerous armed eco-terrorist, and said I was, I said there was a possibility of me causing death and destruction if they came and tried to arrest me, which is ridiculous. There's nothing in my history that would back that up. I've never even struck anybody in anger. So I mean, it's totally ridiculous. But again, when governments decide that they're going to be against you, they will fabricate everything they can. In Canada, I've been charged with the most ridiculous crimes, which we won in the courts. For instance, the Seal Protection Act. I was charged for breaking the Seal Protection Act and conspiracy to break the Seal Protection Act. And because under the Seal Protection Act, it is illegal to approach a seal hunt. It's illegal to film or photograph a seal being killed. It's illegal to actually be on the ice where seals are being killed. And if you break it, they charge you under the Seal Protection Act, which makes it sound like they're defending the seals, not us. Should be the Sealing Industry Protection Act. And when I was working to drive foreign drag trawlers off the Grand Banks in Newfoundland, the charge was three counts of conspiracy to commit mischief. What is mischief? That's what they get you when there's nothing else to do. I was charged with two counts of mischief endangering life, one count of mischief endangering property. I didn't hurt anybody, and I didn't damage any property. But mischief says you could have. And because I could have, there's a possibility that I might have. That's what the charge was. Well, we went into court, and it was a jury trial. It lasted about 2 weeks. And my lawyer opened up the trial by saying, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, we're not going to say we did not do what we're charged with, because we did exactly what we're charged with. We're proud to have done it, and we intend to do it again. And I was acquitted because my defense was the UN World Charter for Nature, which allows for individuals to intervene to uphold international conservation law. And so now when we go up against the krill fishery in the Southern Ocean, we're using the new recently ratified High Seas Treaty for the protection of biodiversity beyond national jurisdictions. So if we get arrested, then we will use that treaty as in our defense.
What is the role that media is playing in, building up that reputation of, you're an eco-terrorist and we should fear you? I understand the politics of it, but I don't understand why the media is not, doing their job of being independent and looking critically at what's happening and holding accountable those powerful people. What do you make of the role of the media in all of that?
There used to be a free media, that is an investigative media that sought to, unveil truths about things that are happening. But very early, I'd say starting in the 70s, corporations and governments decided that they had to control media, to control what was being said. Pretty much all mainstream media is owned or controlled by corporations and or governments, and they do what they're told. So they're no longer there trying to educate anybody or to give them their facts. We don't have great reporters like Walter Cronkite, who was incredible back in, 50 years ago. Now we have people who just do what they're told. And I mean, look at the BBC, for example, basically does whatever the UK government tells them to do, even supporting the fact that if you hold up a sign saying pre-Palestine, that means that you deserve 14 years in jail for terrorism. That's insane. But they support that there because the media is pretty much controlled. Now, the thing is a way around that. is with social media and everything, which they're trying to control through Zuckerberg and Musk and everything like that. But we're constantly having to find new ways of getting that information across. But that social media is also in danger of being co-opted and controlled. And so it's going to get to the point where nobody will have the right to say anything unless that is okayed by the powers that be.
Talking about that, what has, you know, we're in January 2026, what has escaped, you know, people's attention in 2025? What went under the radar in terms of, you know, animal rights?
Well, I think we're making progress. You know, certainly the rise of veganism is something to look at. I mean, I remember, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, I mean, in the 70s, nobody even knew what a vegan was. So, you know, trying to find a vegan restaurant, say in Paris, or it was impossible. You know, that's certainly, there's a lot of growth there. There's a lot of evolution there. And a lot of things that were acceptable as far as abuse of animals back then are no longer acceptable. But the numbers still increase. We kill about 120 billion animals on factory farms every year. It's out of sight and it's out of mind. We grind up newborn chicks into machines and nobody really gives it much thought. So the animal abuse is still there. It's just kept behind closed doors and people don't talk about it. They don't want to talk about it. They don't want to know how meat or things are produced. They just simply don't. And so I find it, we live in an extremely hypocritical society where, you know, we condemn people for instance, with Bridget Bardot, we condemn her because she said something about gays or Islam or something like that. But we ignore the good things that she did. But I know, you know, gay people, if gay people were to criticize me for animal rights, should I condemn all gay people? I mean, really, I remember one time I was walking in Los Angeles and there was a gay couple and they kicked a pigeon. And I said, what do you do that for? And they said, well, they spread disease. And I said, you know, people spread more disease than pigeons do. And they assumed because I said that I was talking about AIDS. I wasn't. I said spreading disease. And they said, well, they called me, you're homophobic. Why? And they said, well, you know, it's assuming that we're spreading disease. I said, I never said any such thing. But I says, I will condemn you for kicking a pigeon. You know, that doesn't mean I hate gay people, you know, but it's just, this is the kind of world we live in. If you do something, then you're going to be condemned right across the board. There's no nuances anymore, really. You're either really good or really bad. It's all black, it's all white, you know.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, what happened, the aftermath of her death is pertinent to our conversations about media because I was just shocked by the number of articles, you know, calling her all sorts of names. And then I would go and read the articles and I was frustrated because they would just give you the label, not the context. Yeah. And, you know, I call for a journalistic honesty. Give us the context. Give us the exact quote of what she said or an account from her victims. And let us decide, you know, what label we should put on Brigitte Bardot. But yeah, judging her and just making a PR thing about it, I thought was just, you know, dishonest.
Yeah, in Reunion, when they were putting hooks through the noses of puppies and dragging them through the water to catch sharks, she said that was savage. It was barbaric. Well, it was. But she got charged for that, for saying the people of Reunion were barbarians and savages or whatever. When she attacks the slitting of the sheep's, the throats of sheep, then somehow or other that becomes anti-Islamic, you know, because of halal and things like this. You know, interesting, by the way, by halal and kosher were originally, they were set up as a more humane way of killing animals. That was what it originally was. And so they made this rule. The rule of law was you have to do it this way to control it, to be more humane. But 2,000 years later, that's no longer the most humane way to do it. But now the rule of law has been changed by, by sort of like this, we have to do it because that's the rule, you know, There's no changing of it. But the spirit of the law is to have a humane kill, which, first of all, I don't believe in such a thing. But anyway, that was the spirit of the law. So that got replaced by the rule, which you have to do it this way. We don't want to hear anything else. This is the way we're going to do it. We don't care if it's more cruel. We don't care. It's just the way we're doing it. This is what the Bible says. This is what the Quran says. This is what we're going to do. I think that's, it's fair to criticize that as barbaric, because it is. It's a 2,000-year-old thing that has no reason to be here. And, but again, you know, a lot of people get concerned about the cruelty involved in slaughter. They got this horrible thing called humane slaughter. I don't even know what that is, humane slaughter. All slaughter is inhumane. You know, there is no justification for the killing of any animal by anyone, anywhere, for any reason. And all these justifications are just unacceptable.
I completely agree with that. There are many fronts to, you know, this animal liberation fight. And, you know, reflecting back on 2025 and beyond, I think I covered marine animals maybe twice. You know, I recorded about now 100 something episodes, and I only, you know, focused on them maybe 2-3 times. And, you know, I feel it's a failure on my part, and I feel it's a bias that many animal rights activists have. We talk a lot about the chickens. It's familiar. We've met lots of chickens. We talk a lot about land animals, but marine animals, you know, they are hidden from us, completely hidden. And we don't have much, you know, way of relating to them. You know, there's just no cute picture of a fish or something of the sort.
It's always difficult to get support for, say, protecting sea cucumbers or urchins or other life forms in the ocean. But it's easy if you got cute little baby seals or whales or dolphins, even sharks, because sharks are considered, you know, sexy, I guess. But it is a difficult thing to get people to be concerned about life right across the board. To me, there's two groups of, there's one plant and one group of animals in the ocean which are absolutely, totally important for our survival, everybody's survival, every species' survival. Phytoplankton, which provides 70% of the oxygen in the air we breathe. Since 1950, it's been diminished by 40%. And the reason it's been diminished is because of the diminishment of whales and dolphins and other creatures that provide the nutrients for the phytoplankton, that is the nitrogen, the iron, and the magnesium, which comes from the feces of these animals, because all of nature is interconnected. And the other, of course, is the zooplankton, which is the foundation of the food chain in the ocean. So that one group of plant and that one group of animals are absolutely essential for the survival of life on this planet. But for the most part, people don't know about it, don't care about it, and they're not interested.
Yes, definitely. Marine life is often, you know, the pitch is you should care about the environment. And so you should, you know, it's an environmental thing, basically. And, you know, keeping them alive and helping them is all about safekeeping the environment. I did an interview a few months ago. We had elections here in Canada, and I interviewed the leader of the Animal Protection Party of Canada. And I asked her, you know, what do you make of environmentalists? Are they allies or enemies of your cause? And she said, most times they're enemies. You know, they don't care about the sentience of the animals. They care about abstractions, and they have some weird ideas about, you know, destroying certain species because they are too dominant in certain ecosystems and all of that. What do you make of that conversation?
Well, there are environmentalists who are concerned about animal rights, and there are environmentalists who don't give a damn. I mean, there's a lot of diversity there. When I was a national director for the Sierra Club in the U.S., there's 15 board members, and four of us were vegetarian or vegan. And the Sierra Club did not want to listen to any talk about, protecting animals at all, because their main concern was it going to alienate all those people who like meat and would no longer support them. The same thing with hunting. They refused to condemn hunting. And I actually resigned from the Sierra Club because of that. They had a contest on why I like to be a hunter. And I'm going, the man who founded the Sierra Club was John Muir. Was an avid anti-hunter. And so I said, this is an insult to the founder of this organization that you're supporting hunting. But their reasoning again, well, we need the hunters because we have a big tent and we need the support from them. So usually it's done because they're concerned about losing financial support, really. But you cannot be an environmentalist if you're a meat eater. Simply can't be. Meat eating, the killing of 120 billion animals every year is the single greatest contributing factor to greenhouse gas emissions, groundwater pollution, and deep dead zones in the ocean. There's more so than the transportation industry. The 40% of all of the fish that's taken out of the ocean is fed, turned into fish meal and fed to pigs and chickens. We have a world now where chickens eat more fish than all the seabirds in the ocean. I mean, that's completely a world out of balance. And that we're taking the krill out of the Southern Ocean. They took 620,000 metric tons this year. They want to take 1.2 million metric tons this year, without any study as to what the impact of that is. Krill is the foundation for the survival of whales and penguins, fish and seabirds and seals in the Southern Ocean. 1.2 million tons of krill is equal to the amount of krill consumed by all of the penguins in the Southern Ocean. So we're just taking a year's supply of food away from the penguins with this. And they're going to starve. They are starving because of this overexploitation, which nobody seems to really care about. So again, it's all interlinked. You cannot be an environmentalist unless you advocate for the rights of animals. And I'd even go even further because I advocate for the rights of nature. I think rivers should have rights. I think trees should have rights. They have a right because I just wrote a book called biocentrism. And to me, I think that that's what we have to adapt is this attitude of biocentrism as opposed to anthropocentrism. Anthropocentrism is this idea that it's all about us. This world was created for us to do whatever we want. We're the only species that's important. Everything else is irrelevant. Biocentrism is the understanding that we're connected with all other species on this planet and that our survival is dependent upon that living in harmony with these other species. We don't live in a world without bees. We don't live in a world with worms or without trees or without fish. We simply do not live in that kind of world. We wouldn't survive. I got a call a few years ago from a reporter from Fox News, and he said, "Did you say at an animal rights conference, did you say that bees, trees, worms, whales, and trees are more important than people?" I said, "Yes, I said exactly that." He said, "Well, how could you say something so outrageous? That's so unchristian." I said, "Well, I said it because they're more important than people, and there's a really simple reason for that. They can live here without us, but we can't live here without them. We need them. They don't need us. That makes them ecologically far more important than we are. So we got to start looking at the world as we're not the dominant, most important species on the planet. We're a citizen species like any other species, and every other species has a right to live here. Every species within an ecosystem has a role to play in upholding the ecological integrity of that ecosystem." Here's one of the things they're always saying about the seals in Canada. "Oh, the seals are out of control. They're eating all of our fish," blah, blah, blah. The population of Harpooned seals in, say, 1550 was about 45 million throughout the North Atlantic and the Arctic Ocean. 45 million seals. Now that number is probably 4 to 5 million. So they've been reduced to around 10%. So how come when there was 45 million of those seals, there was no shortage of fish? The fish were incredibly abundant. As Jacques Cartier and Samuel de Champlain described how you put a basket into the Gulf of St. Lawrence and you pick up fish in the basket. I mean, and these fish were, an average northern cod was about 1 meter long, where now they're about 18 inches. You need a healthy marine mammal population to have a healthy fish population because it's a cycle. On the eastern seaboard of Canada, there are 750 species that are interconnected with each other, and each one complements the other. Okay, harp seals eat fish, but what kind of fish do they eat? Primarily oolakan, halibut, and the fish that smelts, the fish that eat the young cod. So when you lower those fish populations, what happens is you increase the cod population. So you need to have that healthy prey-predator relationship in order to help all those species to be healthy right across the board. So if you're really interested in protecting cod, then you need seals to help out there to keep the other fish populations from becoming too numerous and then taking over. Nature knows how to manage itself. It doesn't need, every time we try to get involved, we screw it up because we don't know anything about it. We remove wolves and that causes all sorts of problems within the ecosystems. We just say, oh, let's put this species here, and now it gets out of control and causes even more ecological problems. Because when it comes to understanding nature, we're total morons. We don't know anything about anything. We should be listening to indigenous peoples and their understanding of the natural world. That's the because they look at the world from a biocentric point of view. That's where we can learn something. But civilization is ecologically very backwards.
Yes, beautifully said. It's a form of species suicide. We are committing like a mass suicide because we are destroying what we need to survive. We are polluting our air and water to such enormous levels, and then we, die of all sorts of cancers, and we wonder why. Well, here's a clue, Okay, I love the idea of biocentrism. You mentioned, Christianity. What do you make of, people's different religious traditions and how they come in conflict with that vision of the world? I make a point on this podcast to, invite, leaders, religious leaders who are vegan and who are making, religious arguments for veganism in their community. I think that's key to making progress. What is your experience on that field?
All major religions are anthropocentric. That means that they all believe we're the dominant life form, that it was all created for us. The world's been 4 billion years old, but 200, 12,000 years ago, somebody said, hey, it was all created for us. And how do we know? It's in a book. We wrote this book. I call it the Goat Herder's Guide to the Galaxy, because these people didn't know anything about anything, but they decided this is where we're going to tell the story. And that, but it completely leaves out all other species, and it's all about control and dominance over this, and that has also led to hierarchies in our civilizations and led to misogyny and all these other things came out of that anthropocentric attitude of that. So I don't have any use for any major religion. I think biocentrism amongst indigenous people, that is something where they understand the relationship between us and the natural world, and that's where we can learn something. But I just see all of these superstitions and customs and things which are outdated and antiquated, which mean nothing at all in a real world, in the real natural world. So I don't have much use for religion. I mean, I even have a theory. I mean, when you really look at it, all the religions get changed so much. You create a religion, and then 100 years later, there's a change, then another 100 change, and everything. And then it has nothing to do with where it originally came from. And that, my own personal belief, based on the research I've done, is that the entire Roman Catholic Church was created because of one man's LSD experience. Now, that might sound very strange, but let's look who founded the Catholic Church. Paul, who never met Jesus. Paul was the founder of the Catholic Church. But Paul was a Jew who was also a Roman citizen, a Greek-born Roman citizen who was Jewish. And he was given the task of going after and persecuting this Christian cult amongst the Jewish community. And on the road to Damascus, he's struck down and temporarily blinded, sees and speaks to God. The only time Paul ever writes about speaking to God was on that one experience. And he's a Roman citizen. And what did Roman citizens carry in their on their what did they eat when they were traveling? Roman meal. Roman meal is raw grains, and one of those grains is rye. And the mold that grows on the rye plant is the only natural source of lysergic acid. It's called ergot. And the symptoms of ergotism are temporary blindness, lameness, and delusions. So the man, I wrote a poem about it called The High Road to Damascus. The man was tripping on LSD when he spoke to God. And I can understand that. I got paid actually to take LSD in 1968. And I had a 45-minute conversation with an orange, but I didn't go out and create a religion on oranges. But, you know, but it all stems from this kind of thing. And it's usually because people didn't have an explanation for something, so let's make up an explanation. And then other people say, oh, yeah, it must be true. And if you look at the history of the Catholic Church, they keep coming, holy water, that's a new invention. Yeah, that sounds good. Let's go with that. Oh, infallibility. Oh, yeah, the Pope's infallible now. Okay, we'll go with that. I mean, it didn't come from the beginning. These are changes that come, and then they become the law. You know, again, the spirit of the law has now been converted to the rule of the law. But I don't have it, so I don't really have it. You know, I've read all the books. I mean, I've read the Bible, I've read the Talmud, I've read the Quran, I've read all the books, like including, Lord of the Rings. They're all religious books. And, that's my conclusion that I come, that there's nothing in there that is supernatural, nothing in there that is divine or is really a revelation. The true understanding of reality is through the observation of nature and the natural world.
Yeah, I think there is a need in people for some kind of spirituality, and they don't know where to find it outside of, you know, mainstream, you know, conventional religions. Where do you find your spirituality?
Well, you know, I would call myself a biocentrist, but I don't have any religious affiliation on that. To me, I feel that I'm part of this planet. I'm part of the ecosystem. I'm part of that living diversity of species, of plants and animals, and everything is connected. So I feel that. That's what my understanding is. I don't think that there's a need for me to institutionalize that and say, okay, we got to pray this or do this or do this little ritual over that or whatever. You know, well, there's no need for that. What you'd have to do is just accept the reality, the beauty of the natural world, and experience it, live it, and enjoy it.
As a sailor, I would have expected a few superstitions here and there.
not superstitious at all. I think most of the superstitions I've come across in my Marine experience have all just been really stupid. I think the only one that ever made any sense was it was bad luck to have a woman on board. And the reason for that was practical, because usually you had one woman and 40 men. That's usually a recipe for for problems. So I can see where that came from. But, the solution to that was to have equal numbers of men and women, and you'd iron that out. But that's the only one to me that ever had any practical understanding as to why it was bad luck.
Well, for 2026, I decided to make the resolution of doing more, you know, covering more what's happening, you know, on the seas and how to marine life. I think we really need to fight this bias and focus more on the oceans. And I'm happy to start the year with a conversation with you. What should we be on the lookout for this coming year in terms of, you know, marine life and your actions with the Paul Watson Foundation?
Well, the one thing I've been saying over and over every year, the one thing that people should be aware of is simply this: if the ocean dies, we die with it. So, you know, we have to take care of marine ecosystems or else the ocean's going to die. It's in the process of dying now. Every single commercial fishery is in a state of collapse. As I mentioned before, the 40% in phytoplankton diminishment, and now we're seeing a major diminishment in zooplankton populations. And, you know, we kill 100 million sharks a year, and then we get all upset because 5 people a year are killed by sharks. When you consider that 200 million people a day go into the ocean and only 5 people are killed every year, that's doing pretty good. The number of people killed every year by Coca-Cola machines falling on them is 9. So the Coca-Cola machine is actually more dangerous than sharks. And it's more dangerous to play golf than it is to swim in the ocean, because more people die every year from bee stings and lightning strikes on golf courses and die in the ocean. So it's all just something not to be concerned with or afraid of. Accidents happen. People get killed by dogs. They get killed by horses. But of course, one of the major, aside from the mosquito, the biggest killer of human beings is other human beings.
Yes, definitely. I think people have a big fear of the oceans, and Hollywood has created this fear of sharks. Although I see, you know, the tourist industry, and they have reduced sharks to like an experience with that cage and all of that.
Well, also, you know, somebody in Switzerland asked me, well, what's the ocean got to do with me? I don't live anywhere near the ocean. Well, the fact is that we all live near the ocean. Because what is the ocean? Most people tend to think of it, it's the beach, it's the sea, you know, but it isn't. This is the ocean planet. It's the planet ocean. And what that means, it's water. It's in continuous circulation. Sometimes it's in the sea. Sometimes it's locked up in ice. Sometimes it's underground. Sometimes it's in the clouds. And sometimes it's in the cell of every plant and animal on the planet. Water flowing constantly through all of those mediums. So the water in your body right now was once recently in the clouds, once recently locked in ice, once in the sea, once underground, or was once in the body of anything from a jaguar to a tulip. I mean, that means we are the ocean. Everything on this planet is the ocean. And it's all the water medium connects us with everything else. And that's what makes this planet what it is and what makes everything truly connected.
Beautifully said. We mentioned a few times the Paul Watson Foundation. Can you explain, you know, what's happening in terms of Sea Shepherd and the Paul Watson Foundation? That's a development I did not pay much attention to. I know you're affiliated now with the Paul Watson Foundation. I learned that from everything that happened on July. So can you clarify things for everyone?
Well, it's a little complicated because I founded the Sea Shepherd Society in 1977, almost 50 years ago. And, you know, it was with a particular purpose of utilizing aggressive nonviolence to intervene against illegal activities. But in 2022, there was a hostile takeover of Sea Shepherd. The reason being is we began to get bigger and we were bringing in money and everything because of whale wars and everything, like, you know, $12, $15 million a year. And now we had people who had nice, comfortable jobs with benefits and everything. And I was a threat to that because they told me I was too controversial. I was too active. I was too confrontational. And so they forced me out of the organization. And but not completely, because I still had the support of Sea Shepherd in France, the UK, and Brazil. So I am still a director of Sea Shepherd in those countries. But because I couldn't utilize, they tried to actually sue me to prevent me from even using my own name, saying I had no right to use my own name. They owned me. And because they had filed trademarks, covertly registered trademarks. So they owned the logos I designed. They owned the name I created. And that's the law. So I had to set up the Captain Paul Watson Foundation outside of France and Brazil and that. The UK changed their name to the Captain Paul Watson Foundation. Not that I wanted to, but people say, well, how come you named it after you? Well, because I thought that would protect it. They couldn't steal it from me. They tried to, but they weren't able to do it. And that. And it's no different than, say, the Jane Goodall Foundation or whatever. I had to do something to protect it. But it's basically the same movement. We haven't changed. The people who took over changed. And they subverted, perverted our what we were set up to do. Turning it into something it was not, and making it a fight. They wanted to go mainstream. That's where they went, the mainstream. My organization was never meant to go mainstream. It was meant to be there on the high seas, taking the risks, doing the things that needed to be done. Since that hostile takeover, what is called Sea Shepherd Global has done nothing. They go out and they take pictures. They talk to governments. They pose with politicians. They don't do anything. So it's a real disappointment to me, having been the founder of that. Now what they're doing is they're trying to prevent me from using archival footage of my history, saying, so they keep taking down things on YouTube or on Facebook or everything, saying, we own those images. I said, you weren't even alive when those images were taken, but say, we own them. And so this is a world we have to deal with where, you know, corporate takeovers, hostile corporate takeovers, and can control the way things go. But we still have, I mean, Sea Shepherd France, Sea Shepherd Brazil still have the passion and the courage and the initiative that we've always had. So I'm really quite proud of them.
Do you think there is Big Ag, Big Fish, Fishermen, Fish, Big Fish, had a role to play in that takeover? Or is this just, you know, conspirational thinking?
It's people, the people who took over, people I knew for 20 years, people that I thought I trusted, but people who now had nice jobs. And now they were being, you know, for instance, I went to court with them, and Alex Cornelison, who's the guy who took over, he said to the judges, well, we had to remove Paul because we were going to lose support from corporations like Allianz Insurance or the Dutch Postal Code Lottery because they said he was too confrontational. So it was a choice between losing the funding or, you know, getting rid of him. So that's what it was really all about, is money. And I said right from the very beginning, money is the least important thing about Sea Shepherd. What's important is the passion, the commitment, and the imagination of the volunteer base that we do that. And they said, but in 2022, you know, in a couple of years, everybody will forget who Paul Watson was. You know, we'll be the new face of Sea Shepherd. They'll forget who he was. And so they're pretty upset that I haven't just faded away quietly and, you know, like they wanted me to do. I haven't done that. I don't intend to do that. And that.
But how do you stay loyal to your values and principles, you know, in the face of all of that, you know, and how do you take care of your mental health too, you know, because your life is a life of many challenges, and that could have been enough, you know, for anyone else to break.
Well, I've always said, you know, it's always something. If it isn't something, it's something else, but it's always something. So there are always challenges to take on. I never disappointed because I expect to be disappointed. And therefore, that doesn't really bother me. I don't have any mental issues over the thing because I really don't care. You know, I'm not materialistic. So it really doesn't really bother me in that respect. I focus on what I have to do, which is the campaigns that we do. That's my focus on that. And if they take away this tool, then I'll have to go and find another tool. But, you know, that's all you can really do. But I've been doing this now for 50 years. I don't believe in retirement. I don't intend to retire. I don't get tired about it. I'm not on that. So I don't get depressed and I don't get pessimistic because I learned many years ago that you have no power over the future at all, none. But you have absolute power over the present. So what you do in the present will define what the future will be. So I focus on the present, never on the future.
Very Buddhist of you.
Well, I wouldn't say it's Buddhism because I don't really believe that. But
I guess, what is then your advice for activists? You know, my podcast has mostly a base of activists. What do you have to say to them?
I think that my advice, especially to young people, is don't get depressed, don't get pessimistic, and again, focus on the future. But what you have to understand is each and every one of us has the power to change the world. And it really means the application of three virtues. Passion. Be passionate about something. Two, the courage to take it on. And three, the imagination to come up with the means to take it on. And that's what changes the world. Because of Diane Fossey, we still have mountain gorillas in Rwanda. Look at the work of Jane Goodall. Look at Greta Thunberg's another example on that. These are people who are changing the world because they're not deterred by criticism. They don't get depressed. They don't get pessimistic about it. But I think you do have to focus. And if everybody were to focus on this particular species, is this particular ecosystem, or this particular strategy, even veganism is another means you can focus on, and focus entirely on that. Don't get spread out. Don't get your energies all over the place. You know, focus on what you do. Because people say, well, why do you focus on marine wildlife? I said, well, first of all, that's pretty big. But I used to, you know, I got involved. I spent a year with elephants. I spent a year on wolves and everything. But I kind of came to the point, I really got to focus on doing one particular thing, and that's I decided on marine life, which again isn't one, it's vast, but still. So right now I'm focusing on real threats to the ocean, the krill fishery down in the Southern Ocean, Seabed mining, which is a major, major problem. Overfishing, poaching, that kind of thing. 40% of all the fish that are caught illegal. Also trying to oppose salmon farming, which is a highly destructive industry, which is one of the reasons we're killing off the krill in order to provide a cheap protein base for the salmon. So there's so many problems that we have to commit. But, the strength of an ecosystem is in diversity. Therefore, the strength of a movement is in diversity. And so it really doesn't matter how you approach that. You really have to say, what am I good at? Because that approach can be litigation, it can be education, it can be legislation, it can be activism, it can be media. It doesn't matter as long as you're good at it and you can apply that, what you're good at, towards making a change.
Just out of curiosity, going back to politics, what did you make of those Trump comments of, owning Greenland?
Trump's an idiot. But again, here's the one thing about Trump that's different than pretty much all other political leaders, including Carney in Canada. Trump's honest. He says what they all think. They all want to do what he's doing and that, but he just does it. They don't believe in they're addressing climate change. He just says, I don't believe in addressing climate change. Do you think Carney believes in it? He doesn't. He's not going to do anything. He was when he was president of the Bank of England. He was very outspoken about it. But as soon as he became prime minister, complete about face on that. Because it's not possible for any world leader to address issues like climate change, because any decision they make is going to be political suicide. Because we live in a political reality or an economic political reality that you cannot change the course of that ship without having a mutiny of the people who support the operation of that ship against you. You're going to piss off the oil companies, you're going to piss off the banks, and they're going to you're not going to have their support, and therefore you're out the window, as far as being effective anymore. So no solution will ever come through government. Never has, never will. Slavery wasn't ended by a government. It was ended by the passion of Wilberforce and Douglas. Women didn't get the right to vote because of the U.S. government. And for instance, they got the right to vote because of the suffragettes who had to get, were bleeding in the streets and thrown into jails and everything to get it. And by the way, when they did get the right to vote, it was that 21st Amendment was a 20th Amendment, which one it is, but it was signed by Woodrow Wilson, the President of the United States. He was their main opponent. He was totally opposed to women getting the right to vote, but he gets to sign it. Now history gives him the credit for giving women the right to vote. So that's how politicians are good at taking credit, but people are what get things done. All social movements are driven by individuals. Now here's the other thing. You don't need 100% of the people on your side to create a movement. Movements change the world. You just have to create a movement, and all you need is 7%. 7%, that's the French Revolution, American Revolution, whatever. 7%, and you've got yourself a movement. But we're a long ways from 7% right now. There's more subscribers to Warcraft than there are active environmentalists or vegetarians in the world, So we still got a long ways to go education-wise. But that's what we have to strive for, that 7%. Not 100%. We'll never get 100% because 93% of human beings are just fucking stupid. They're not going to go anywhere. They just go along. All they care about is, am I going to get paid? Am I going to have any benefits? Can I watch television? Can I play that video game? This is what their primary concern is. And that's the reality, unfortunately. That is the reality. People are the problem. When people say, well, Brigitte Bardot hated people. Yeah, why? Well, she had every reason to be. She was witness to what they do, the incredible, inhumane perversions of the human species are enough to turn anybody off of people. So misanthropic people, that's the reason they're misanthropic. Now, here's the interesting thing about misanthropic people, because I'm very misanthropic, is I like people individually once I get to know them. But as a species, they're deplorable. Absolutely deplorable. I mean, just look at the history of what we do. I mean, the ultimate insanity on this planet is war. I mean, what kind of idiot goes into a trench and shoots at somebody else who they don't even know just to so you can gain territory for somebody you don't know who decides to give you the orders to do it? I mean, it's ridiculous. Hundreds of millions of people dying in stupid wars for stupid reasons. That's insanity. Absolutely. And again, anthropocentrism is the reason behind that.
A few words about that diversity. I think in the past year, I've seen, at least if you're connected with social media, lots of infighting in the animal rights, you know, community, vegan community, and about nothing, absolutely nothing. You know, it's just details about certain positions and who the people are exactly, and so much energy spent on those little fights, and you know, it felt very discouraging. And it's a trend of, you know, not tolerating different opinions or different personalities, or not being able to work with people who have different belief systems, but do agree with you that we should not be, you know, killing innocent sentient creatures left and right. What do you make of all that dissension in the community?
It's human nature. It's all about competitive purism. You know, I'm a better human being than you are because I do this and you don't do that, or something like that. I mean, I saw these comments. Oh, Bridget Bardot wasn't she's a vegetarian. She wasn't a vegan. So what? You know, who cares? I mean, you know, go after people who are eating meat, you know, forget about that. Or this person wasn't as good a vegan as this person was a good a vegan. And that vegan restaurant, you know, they served this meal, which, you know, was actually made in the same place where it was such and such. I mean, it's just bullshit, really. It's total, you know, just people need to be more tolerant. Movements have an incredible capacity for self-destruction through infighting based on the most trivial of reasons on that. You know, I see vegans attacking vegetarians. Why? It makes no sense, you know. So, you know, I see vegans attacking other vegans because you're not a vegan for the right reason. Well, what's the right reason? Then they go lay out their reasons. I once wrote a little post called 50 Shades of Veganism, you know, vegans who do this, vegans who do that. Vegans, I'm a vegan because my girlfriend's a vegan. That kind of stuff, all sorts of reasons for them being vegan. But here's the ultimate, the bottom line. It doesn't matter. Every time anybody does something that results in an animal not being abused and killed is a victory. So if somebody eats meat on one day a week, that means that 7 days a week or 6 days a week that those animals were spared from their, you know, the destruction that they were causing. Let's embrace that and not turn these people off, you know. My ships have been, they were vegetarian from 1980 to 2000, and from 2000 onwards, they were vegan. And nobody, you don't have to be a vegan to be on my crew, but you have to be a vegan to be on the crew because that's all you're going to eat, you know, because there's no other choice. And so what we do is we introduce people to veganism through experience. And they suddenly, after 3 months at sea, they discovered, oh, I didn't die, you know. Oh, and I left the ship healthier than when I came on. That's a learning experience and everything. But the one thing that people do not like is proselytizing, you know. You know, it's like Jehovah's Witnesses on the door. Have you met Jesus? No, and I don't want to. That kind of. But, you know, but it's the same with veganism. You can't preach this stuff by making people ashamed and guilty for what they do. You have to encourage them and offer real examples and experiences to have them make their choice to do that, you know. And that's what I found on my ships. People who are complete meat eaters left the ships vegan because they realized they didn't die and they were healthier.
And I guess one last question about, you know, politics. How should people interact or look at their government, and not any people, vegans, you know? You mentioned how, you know, it's not governments that make, you know, progress. I do agree with that. But people are more and more reliant on their government. When the pandemic happened, I was kind of disappointed to see how many people were ready to, you know, snitch on their neighbors because they were having a gathering, or, you know, not, I don't know, putting their mask on or something like that, to their government, you know. And you see that with social media in places like the UK, you know, people reporting others, their neighbors, because they made some distasteful posts on their Facebook. And it's just, it feels very much like a
1984?
Yes, Yes. It's a very Orwellian world. What do you make of that?
Well, like I said, I don't think much gets accomplished with government. With one exception, local governments and municipal governments, that's where things actually can make a difference. There are changes on the local level. For instance, in Nice in France, you know, it was the mayor who set up the marine protection areas off outside of the city and that. And I think that real changes can be made at that level. When you get into higher governments, like provincial or federal or whatever, then you get into so many conflicting ideas. And it's now becomes a fight over whose idea is going to be victorious and everything. And they just waste all of their time just fighting over that whole thing. So very little actually gets decided on that. And and then what happens is lobbies like the Israeli lobby or the oil lobby comes in and tells people, this is the way you're going to vote or else you're not going to get our support. And if you don't get our support, you're not going to be in power. So basically, I think Mark Twain once described the U.S. Congress as the parliament of whores. You know, everybody's bought on that. So I don't think anything can be accomplished on those levels. But I do believe, I still feel that on a local level, in cities and towns, that government can make a difference there.
Yeah, cheers to that. I'm all about, decentralization of powers, giving that power back to the people directly. And also, yes, I'm for independent media. That's why I launched this podcast. Paul, this has been truly a pleasure. I learned a lot from this conversation. Did you want to add something before we stop the recording?
I don't know. I think we covered everything. Is there anything you think we missed?
No, I think, well, I would invite people to donate to the Captain Paul Watson Foundation. I think it's a worthy cause led by a man who is loyal to his values and who is also transparent about them. I think, often organizations are behind a veil of, darkness. You don't know who are those people behind that brand. But I like to organizations that are open about their staff. Here are our people and here's what we believe, and support us if you feel inspired to.
All right, thank you.
So Paul, again, thank you so much for all of your work and for having accepted my invitation. Again, this has been a pleasure.
Well, you're welcome. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. I kindly invite you to share this podcast with the vegans you know. Let's encourage more people to take action. Again, thank you so much for caring, and I will see you next Tuesday for a new episode.
Ranger les vacances dans des valises en carton. Et c'est triste quand on pense à la saison du soleil et des chansons. Pourtant je sais bien l'année prochaine tout refleurira, nous reviendrons. Mais en attendant je suis en peine de quitter la mer. Ma maison.